So my daughter is always asking me these interesting questions. Interesting in that I think they're really good and they're very thoughtful, but not interesting in the sense that I don't have a clue how to answer them. This week she asked me, Mom, how do you know that Jesus is God?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, there's lots of spiritual leaders out there, men that we know through history, like Gandhi, like Buddha, like Confucius, like Jesus. Why do we place such an emphasis on Jesus Christ?
Well, unlike those other people who are supposedly enlightened and wise and prophets and teachers, Jesus is all of that, of course. He is that. He's described as the light coming into the darkness. And I think like in the early chapters of John, and I think what John means by that is that he's come to bring enlightenment, to give us the truth, to help us to understand what's really going on. Those claims are made of a lot of people, a lot of religious leaders throughout all time. But what's unique about the claim that the Bible makes about Jesus is that he's the one who, before there even was a world, had been designated by God as the one who is going to be king of a kingdom that God would establish. So,
you're saying that he was the only one that really had a prophecy about him? It was determined long, long ago that he would be around?
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily true. At least claims are probably made about other religious leaders being the fulfillment of certain predictions. More to the point is that I don't think there's even a concept of what we call the Messiah, that any other religion even has the concept of the Messiah the way that the Bible does. That the Messiah is that one who is to be anointed by God to serve in this unique function of being a king, who would be the very embodiment of the character and person and power and authority of God himself incarnate in the flesh, in human form. And that's who Jesus is. His role, he was that when he came to the earth, but really only in name, only in title, only in commitment by God and promise. He won't actually rule where, as the Bible puts it, all of his enemies will be made as a footstool for his feet. That's not going to happen any time during this present age. It's going to happen when this whole earth is destroyed and God recreates a new heavens and a new earth. In that new heavens and new earth will exist the kingdom of God in its fruition. And there Jesus is going to reign physically as king. And the title that's given to that is the Mashiach in Hebrew, or we call it the Messiah. In Greek, he's called the Christos, and in English we call it the Christ. All four of those, Mashiach, Messiah, Christos, Christ, all mean exactly the same thing. The one anointed by God to that particular role. Incidentally, that's what the term Son means as well. When Jesus refers to himself as the Son, or even more, he more often refers to himself as the Son of Man, or when we refer to him as the Son of God. Contrary to a lot of popular opinions about what that means, what the Bible means by the Son is simply the one who is functioning as the Messiah.
Okay, so we've got a bunch of terms that mean Messiah.
Right.
One is, of course, Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus as the Christ, Jesus as the Son of God, Jesus as the Son of Man, and Jesus the Son.
Exactly.
And all of those really are just this, mean the same thing. They're what they mean is this man who was put on earth, who is going to one day, in the kingdom of God, rule over everything.
Right, right.
As God does now.
Right.
And this is a claim that's different than, say, Buddha's. In what respect?
Well, Buddha simply taught the way that any and all of us can follow to achieve the same spiritual end that he did, which was a kind of enlightenment, a kind of absorption into the ultimate nothingness, in his case. And he was simply somebody who went ahead of us in spiritual enlightenment, became enlightened and achieved that spiritual goal, and if we follow the path that he has laid out, then we can as well.
He was not saying, I am God in the flesh. He was saying, I'm a man who has a way to enlightenment, and I'd like to lead you there.
Right, right. He might have said in a sense that's completely foreign to our way of thinking as Christians, that I'm God in the flesh in another sense, that is, I am ultimately as supreme as anything can be. But he doesn't mean the same thing that the Bible means. What the Bible means is that Jesus was unique in being God incarnate. You and I are not God incarnate. We're made in the image of God. I mean, we're not nothing. We're not insignificant creatures. And the creatures that we are reflect the glory and the character and the nature of God in a way that the other animals do not. All that's true. But that's different from saying, I am actually God incarnate. That's a different claim. But that's the claim that the Bible is making for Jesus. Jesus is actually God uniquely, God in a way that none of the rest of us are God. As Paul puts it, he is the visible image of the invisible God. And that's not a claim that he would make about any other human being. That's a claim that only uniquely belongs to Jesus.
My daughter has a Mormon friend, and she said to me the other day, Mom, how come we know that Jesus was God and so important, and Joseph Smith wasn't so important? How do you really know that? And I guess it would be true for anyone else. How do we know? How do we know that Jesus is and not Buddha? How do we know that Jesus is and not any other spiritual leader that is claiming authority here?
Well, that's a very good and a very good question, and one that's a very complex question. Or what I mean by that is the answer is complex, because I think there's really there's no simple answer to the question of how do we know that Jesus is the Messiah. I think the way I know that Jesus is the Messiah, and I think I am characteristic of most human beings, the way I know that Jesus is the Messiah comes from a lot of different factors all lining up to point in the same direction, that Jesus really is who he says he is.
What are those factors?
I'm not sure I know all of them, but some of the more important ones. If the biblical accounts are true, I'll get back to that in a second, but if the biblical accounts are true, what we have described is a man who startled us with things happening in his life that were manifestly supernatural. I don't mean ambiguous. I don't mean they could have been supernatural, but not the sleight of hand of magicians where you don't know how they did it. Not the kind of miracles that we often see in church culture today, where cancer going into remission or remarkable medical things happening that do happen in any circumstances, being correlated with prayer, and that we're inclined to want to call it a miracle. Not sure, but we're inclined to want to call it a miracle. Jesus performed supernatural deeds where there was no ambiguity, there was no question. They were just simply manifestly the hand of God reaching into our mundane, ordinary experience and doing something striking and startling and remarkable.
As the resurrection.
Like the resurrection, yeah, exactly. John calls them signs. And what he means by that is they are evidences of Jesus' credential. He said he was the Son of God, and he put his money where his mouth was, or he put his deeds where his mouth was, in that he his life was filled with these remarkable credentials of somebody who had an authority from God that not your ordinary person has. And we have to put, in order to feel the force of that, we have to put it in this context. As I understand it, those things did not happen in the context of a superstitious culture where there was a miracle around every bush. Sometimes people suggest that that was the culture, but I think they're just historically wrong. Those people were amazed by what Jesus did. They weren't going after all these other people who were claiming to perform miracles. Jesus was the one performing miracles, and they were startled by that and amazed by that. Jesus makes a very interesting, sarcastic comment at one point. He has cast out a demon from a person, and the demon was having the effect of making the man, I think, speechless, dumb, not unable to speak. And a group of Pharisees are there, and I don't remember if they asked Jesus or whether they just questioned among themselves, how did he do that? By what authority did he cast out this demon? And some of them were suggesting, well, it's probably by Beelzebul, the prince of demons, that he cast out demons. And either Jesus was a part of the conversation, or he read their minds and hearts, or overheard them or something. But he says, that's not a very sensible suggestion. Why a kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. Why would the prince of demons be casting out demons? That doesn't make any sense. And somewhere in that context, he says, if it's by Beelzebul that I cast out demons, by what authority do your sons cast out demons? Now, that's kind of a cryptic comment, but I think the best way to understand what he means by that is as a point of irony and sarcasm. He's saying, here I am with the authority to cast out demons, and you've just seen me do it, and you've seen me do it before. I clearly have the authority to cast out demons. Which of your disciples, son, which of your sons is a way of saying which of your disciples in their idiom. He's saying, which of your disciples has ever cast out a demon? And I think the answer is obviously none, nowhere. They don't have the authority, they have never done it. So here they are, the only man that they've ever seen in their experience with the authority to cast out demons, and they're trying to discredit it as being somehow evil instead of good. And the point that he's making is, this is a really, your rationalization to dismiss me is really stretching it. What you ought to be focusing on is the fact that none of you have the authority to cast out demons, and I do. And what does that mean? What's the significance of that? And I think implicit in his rhetoric there is, the significance is, I'm the Messiah. I am what I say I am. I have the authority from God, from my Father, to come and tell you the truth and to lead the way into the kingdom of God.
He's saying your argument is weak and there's no way around it.
Right, exactly. I think so. Because as you go on in that passage, then he actually tells a little kind of allegorical fable about the nature of rationalization and the nature of unbelief, and how a person has to deliberately harden themselves to the truth in order to avoid believing it when they're confronted with evidence like that.
Okay, one of the ways that we know that Jesus is the Messiah, that we're convinced of that, or that you were saying you're convinced of that, is by the signs,
right,
by the miracles.
Yeah, by what he actually performed in his lifetime. Now, all that, of course, depends upon the accuracy of the records, because I wasn't there. I wasn't an eyewitness to these things. I'm taking their word for it. Why would I take their word for it? Well, that's a judgment call that we make. At this point in my life, I've read a lot of ancient literature, and a lot of ancient Greek literature, a lot of ancient Roman literature, the Babylonian literature, the Egyptian literature. The gospel accounts stand out as rational, sane, moderate, as having integrity, as being the product of non-superstitious, non-hysterical, non-fraudulent people who are giving us their honest account of things they actually saw, things they actually heard, and they're trying to come to terms with the meaning of what they really saw and what they really heard.
It doesn't feel like histrionics.
Right.
It feels like it's solid. It's backed by reason, understanding. doesn't feel crazy. I guess some of the literature back then must feel kind of crazy, kind of off the cuff.
Right. I mean, you look at the Roman historians, and that's pretty sober stuff. For the most part, they're just trying to figure out what happened, who did what, when. But they don't hesitate when they lack other information from reliable sources. They don't hesitate to say, well, here's what the legend says. Like the beginning of Rome and all the legend about Romulus and Remus and the two twins and being raised by wolves and all that kind of stuff is that they give their judgment about, I think this part of the legend probably doesn't make any sense and probably isn't right, and I don't know about this part of the legend, but you know, this is what the legend says and there must be some truth to some of it maybe. But they don't hesitate to introduce that into the account. What's so remarkable about the Gospels is you have none of that. You don't have any legendary material that even feels like legend.
It's firsthand.
It's firsthand stuff that somebody has seen and reported, and that the disciples themselves recognize is plausible and coherent with everything else that they know. So it has a very, very different feel to it.
Now, that isn't true for the Old Testament, however. There's people reporting about not what they saw.
Right. Like creation account and
yeah.
And things like that.
Oh,
yeah.
Many things.
Yeah, that's true. And at that point, then, let me bring the third thing into it. I mean, one of the things, the reason I accept the Old Testament is largely because Jesus did, and I have become convinced that Jesus is who he says he is, the light shining into the darkness, the Messiah sent from God, the one who knows what's going on and what this is all about. And if the Old Testament was scripture to him, it would be crazy for me to not make it scripture to me, because he knows what he's talking about. So the third factor that's really important to me when all is said and done is, what's the content of what Jesus taught? What's the content of what the apostles taught? What's the content of what the Old Testament prophets taught? When I really come to thoroughly understand it, and I simply sit back and ask myself the question, does that match the reality of my life? Does it explain my experience? Or is this foolishness? Is this just completely missing it? Is this completely fairy tale stuff that is totally out of touch with reality? Or, just based on my own experience as being a human being, does this ring true? Does this really make sense out of my experience? And I think that's a really important thing as well. There are a lot of other religions that I have not investigated as thoroughly as I have Christianity. One of the reasons I haven't investigated them as thoroughly is when I just look at the content of what they're saying, I really have difficulty seeing that it has anything to offer me in terms of an explanation of my experience.
Can you give us an example?
Well, let's take Buddhism, for example. There's different interpretations of Buddhism, and I'm certainly not an expert on Buddhism, but there's two features of Buddhism that are really important. One is that ultimately, for me to lose my identity is the ultimate goal of my existence. For me to be absorbed into nothingness, nirvana is a loss of my own individual identity. You know, I either get absorbed into nothingness or I absorbed into the all and I'm just a part of the all and don't have any distinct individual identity any longer at all. And that somehow I am supposed to take solace in the fact that really if I follow this path and I get there one day, my individual identity will be obliterated and no longer will I suffer and no longer will I grieve. No longer will I have anything to be disappointed about, because I will just cease to have any conscious existence like that. Well, there's nothing about that strikes me as interesting or as good news. I mean, it doesn't resonate with my heart that screams out that my own individual existence is a significant existence and that it would be a tragedy for my individual existence to not go on and to persist and to find its fulfillment as an individual. To lose my individuality seems to go counter to everything my heart wants, not to fulfill everything my heart wants. So I don't, you know, I really don't investigate it all that much because I've already been put off by it. It doesn't sound right to me. It doesn't ring true to me. Also, part of Buddhism is what fuels it is all the suffering and pain in the world, and the need to stop the pain and stop the suffering, to get beyond the pain and suffering somehow. Christianity has a very different perspective on pain and suffering in this world, as we've talked about to some extent, that pain and suffering in this world, as unpleasant as it is meaningful and productive and significant. It's a significant part of my growth as an individual and my growth toward my ultimate fulfillment. It has a role that it plays in that regard. And so ultimately my suffering is not something to be transcended, it's something to be gone through, something to be endured, something to be experienced. Well, that's a very, very different, radically different concept of suffering. So I have to ask myself the question, which one rings more true? As I look at two people in the world, the one who spends his life trying to avoid suffering and transcend it and escape it, and the one who goes through the suffering, and who ends up being the more whole, mature, human being? I think it's the one who goes through their suffering. So just at that level, Christianity seems to have it right. Buddhism seems to have it wrong. And that's something that I can judge from my own observations, my own reflections on my own experience. I don't need to trust other people for that. I can determine that from where I stand.
So let me review. The reasons that you think that the Bible is true, that Jesus Christ really is the Messiah, are many, but you've named three here today. Some of them, I think, are just subjective and they're hard to grasp. One is, the Bible account is a sober account. It lacks histrionics. It's first-hand account, especially in the New Testament, of what people actually saw, which in your study of the ancient cultures is unique in that sense. There's lots of legends, there's lots of hearsay in other accounts about other things, but in the New Testament, it's just hard reality of what occurred in people's lives, and they're reporting it. And then you said, just in tandem with that, in regard to the Old Testament, is Jesus said the Old Testament has validity, and so you're taking his word for it since you're standing with the New Testament. Mm-hmm. So they kind of come as a package for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just because of what Jesus taught, and yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I'm forgetting the first one, but the third one was, it just fits with your experience. Your experience says, this really fits with my life, it makes sense, it's coherent with what seems right. And so you seem compelled to believe it because it isn't counter to what your heart naturally yearns after.
And I think really ultimately that's always the most important factor in anybody's belief or unbelief.
This subjective one.
Yeah. I actually hesitate to call it subjective, because it's ultimately rational. It's ultimately a rational decision that I'm making. I would use the word intuitive perhaps more than subjective, just because in our day and age, in our culture, subjective suggests relative to me. That is, it's true for me as for who I am. It may not be true for you as to for who you are. I know subjective doesn't have to mean that, but it has those kinds of connotations in our culture. So to avoid using that term, I might use the word intuitive. There's just all kinds of factors that my mind is working overtime to take into account when I assess, is the overall worldview here compatible with the experience that I actually have? I think that's what weighs the strongest for us, is my intuition about what makes sense to me. And I think that's operative both in belief and in unbelief. We've talked about this before, that the whole notion of sanctification is the Spirit of God coming into my life and making me open to the truth about reality. Most of us, left to ourselves naturally, would prefer to make up a story about reality, to make up some kind of fantasy about reality. I want reality to be this way, so I'm going to think about reality this way, I'm going to believe about reality this way. Then Jesus comes along and teaches us the truth, and it doesn't sound very interesting to us. It's jarringly different from the reality that I really am committed to because I want this other thing to be true. I mean, at a mundane level, I don't really want the reality, the truth to be that I'm an unworthy sinner, worthy of eternal punishment, of eternal condemnation. That's not an attractive idea to me. So unless something has happened to make me unusually open to the truth about myself, then Jesus' teaching and the worldview of the Bible is not going to ring true to me, because it's not going to match this story that I'm telling myself about reality that I prefer. And my intuition is going to tell me that Christianity stuff is just garbage, that's just junk, that's just foolishness, but I don't know why anybody would believe that, because this fantasy over here is a whole lot more attractive to me. By the same token, if I have been given eyes to see and ears to hear, as Jesus puts it, and I have my eyes open as I go through life and watch people and observe people, watch myself, observe myself, notice what's true about human beings and the world and God in relationship to human beings and so on, all of a sudden I realize, wow, what I see happening over here in my life is exactly what Jesus was describing over here in his teaching, and exactly what Paul was describing in his teaching. And I go, wow, that's phenomenal. How did they know that? Well, the reason they knew that is because they were speaking the truth, and they were speaking the truth because they had been given their wisdom from God himself. And that becomes a huge, huge factor in my being convinced that this really is what it claims to be.
I think one of the biggest convincing factors, and I think I've said this before on this show, for me, is that I studied psychology. And more than that, I sat in the room in a counseling office with people day after day after day after day, experiencing life and telling me just the core of their experiences, hard experiences, really hard experiences, private ones, hidden ones, ones that most people don't get to know about other people. And out of that, I came to see the truth of the gospel, because it tells, they match. I don't have to reach very far to find the core of human experience and know what that really is across the board, for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, everybody, you know, has a similar core. And then I look at what the gospel says about us, and it makes sense. It's in line. And so that's more how I came to be convinced, to seeing people at their core level and then comparing it to Scripture and saying, wow, this is true, this is real. And so that's my intuitive perspective of the gospel. It just makes sense. It's just absolutely undeniable for me. It's a hard thing, though, like when my daughter asked, how do you know, Mom? How do you know it's true? I don't really know how to explain it to her. It's not something that's easy to explain to a child. It's a great question. And what I did, quite honestly, is, you know, I think people out there will think, well, Christine probably gave a really good answer, and boy, I wish I could be like that. I wish I could give good answers, but I'm just kind of a failure as a parent, and I don't do a good job. And that's just absolutely not true. I didn't do a good job. I was kind of tongue-tied, and I punted for a while until she said, well, how do you even know, Mom, that God is true? Well, that one was easier for me. I said, Leah, you see through your eyes, don't you? Do you think that those eyes just evolved? Or do you think possibly they were created? And I said, now use your eyes and look at that flower. We were sitting at my table and there was this flower. And if you ever look at a flower, it's just incredible. You see its veins and its colors and it's just, the detail of it is absolutely beautiful. And she looked at it and she turned to me kind of astonished and she said, Mom, I see what you mean. God has to be real. And that's my experience of God as being real. Just walking outside last night and seeing a piece of the moon and a tree and then a star on the other side. And it just is an act of incredible creation. It must be. It has to be. I sat there in wonder and thought, how can people, I don't get how people cannot see that. I'm short-sighted there. But God just seems so real as I look at my body, as I look at the wonder of people's cognition, of our ability to be rational, to feel, to intuit, to understand. We're created.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the intuition that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was reading a book on the existence of God once, and it was a book about a debate between two different ways of thinking about how we know that belief in God is rational. One is by evidence, and one is by a kind of God-given intuition. And they were arguing which is which. And the book describes a debate between these two people, or two people of these persuasions, on a radio talk show. And a woman called in and said, I don't know what you guys are talking about. If you want to know whether God exists, just look out the window. Something like that, something to that effect. And I can't remember what point the book went on to make, but I thought that was very striking, because it really does illustrate what I think is true, and that is our belief that God exists, the rationality of our belief, the reasons why we believe that God exists, cannot ultimately be reduced to a philosophical argument. I think philosophical arguments can approximate them. I mean, they can kind of point in the direction of why we know that God exists. But any given philosophical argument is not going to do justice to the intuition itself. Mm-hmm. And so some other philosopher can come along and challenge this assumption, or challenge this particular deduction that you make on some grounds. You can always find a way to think that the argument is just not airtight. You know, there's some weakness to the argument. But that's the argument that you're finding is not airtight. But the argument is just a pale comparison to the intuition that we all have. And I think that's what you're talking about. But ultimately, that intuition is both objective and rational. I mean, I like to think of an intuition as, if our minds were computers, our minds normally chug along at, you know, not very fast, just kind of methodically cranking out step after step after step in an argument. And that's how we have to do philosophy, is step by step, premise by premise, conclusion by conclusion, and so on. We just lay it all out linearly. But our minds are also capable of these kind of supercomputer speeds, where it's just processing and crunching all kinds of deductions, all kinds of data, all kinds of experience, all kinds of observation, and it's just with lightning speed putting all that stuff together and coming up with what I think is a logical conclusion. It is my rationality at work. It's not that our intuitions are infallible, but I would argue they are always rational. They're not coming out of blue sky. They're coming out of our experience, our observations, facts, information that we have. We're putting all that together and coming to the conclusions. But it's happened at a level of our rationality where, if you ask me, how'd you come to that conclusion, I cannot readily tell you, because I did not consciously go through all the steps methodically, bit by bit. And that's one of the skills that a philosopher tends to have, is to be able to take their intuitions and slow it down to frame-by-frame speed and be able to go back and retrace the steps and articulate, well, here's how I got there.
Oh, so that's why I'm not a philosopher.
Well,
because I can slow it down.
Yeah, I think there is a knack that a philosopher has that not everyone necessarily has that doesn't make them any more intelligent. It just makes them slower.
Well, in a sense, I was thinking just that, Jack. It doesn't make them slower. It makes them almost question what is.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I remember one time very, very early in my career as a counselor. In fact, I don't know if I had even... Well, I just gotten my degree. And I was in a new community, and there was a woman in the crowd. I was teaching something. There was a woman in the crowd who asked me something very personal about herself. And I just looked at her, and I knew what she was talking about. I knew that the direction she was going wasn't right. And I just, bam, I just told her. She was shocked. She said, "My heavens, I've been trying to get this for years." She was about 75 years old. "And you nailed it." And I remember sitting back and going, "How'd I know that?" I don't know that.
Right.
But I just got it. And that was when I really started to have some confidence in myself as a counselor, interestingly enough, because I started believing in my intuition. And now as a counselor, that's what I work with. I work, in fact, not to be a philosopher, not to tear it down too much, because then I miss, through the minutiae, I miss the reality. I miss what needs to be seen more than the steps to get there. I remember one time my dad said to me, he really loves Laura Schlesinger. He listens to her all the time. She's a talk radio host who answers personal moral questions. Talking about it, and he goes, boy, she really knows what she's talking about. She always has answers. She always can back up what she says. And I thought, I thought, I can't do that. I don't really know why my answers are always the answers that they are. And he goes, oh, that's too bad, Christine. You should know. And then I thought, well, that would be great if I could do both, but I don't. My intuition has spoken really well for me and usually speaks very correctly. And I think what we've done, probably throughout history, is we've set aside this intuition that you're calling rational, in the sense that it's real, as I'm thinking of it. It makes sense. But we set it aside because we don't trust it. Mm-hmm. And we haven't learned to trust it and to work with it. We learn to distrust it, and in fact to think, if I don't have an argument that makes me know that it's true, and I think particularly in this day and age, then I have to throw it out. And I think that's a huge mistake, and I'm glad to hear you say it. There's a song that I heard and loved way back when I used to go to Calvary Chapel when it first opened. And I don't know people that know about it, but in California, Calvary Chapel went from, like, when I was going there, 50 people to, it seemed like 50,000. It was just enormous. It exploded. And we used to sing we sang songs for hours and hours, and I loved to do that. But there was one song that was, have you seen Jesus, my Lord? He's here in plain view. Take a look. Open your eyes. He'll show it to you. Have you ever stood at the ocean, and I'm going to misquote it, and seen the white foam at your feet, felt the endless powering motion? Then I'd say, yeah, you've seen Jesus, my Lord. And this is what they were talking about. There is a reality there. You just have to look, and you can see the creativity. You can see God.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, we do have to be careful, because there are a lot of people who have had intuitions and trusted intuitions that are just false. And that's the value of slowing down, is that...
Slowing down or testing it out? Against
both.
Doing reality checks.
Both, yeah. That we have to do reality checks. And there are different ways to do reality checks, you're right. My way as a philosopher of doing it is to really get introspective and try to figure out, why did I come to the conclusion? Why do I think that? And what you sometimes discover is, what you thought the conclusion was the conclusion to, it was actually the conclusion to something else. I mean, part of it is, we don't even really know what the question was that my answer is the answer to.
And so really
we sometimes have to identify that. We have to slow down enough to sort that out. Or we can do a reality check by making sure we keep seeing the same thing, and that we're not imposing an interpretation on somebody's life or somebody's behavior or somebody's attitudes, but that we really are seeing it.
And I would say, when I have an intuition, I put it out there as a hypothesis in my mind. I think this is what I see. Here, let me give this to you and see how this fits with your experience of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And letting people work with it. And sometimes just a light turns on and it's just clear that it's there. Other times people say, no, that's not it. So I hold on to it on the sideline and I wait and see if they come to it. And sometimes they do.
Right.
So you can't even know up front necessarily, but I think that it's really an asset in life to be able to at least put those intuitions out there, have the curiosity and the courage to do that, and then also have the courage to see if they're right or wrong and not have to hold on to them too tightly.
Yeah, and that's the key. I mean, that just like philosophical argumentation and rational argument, we need to hold it with humility. We can make mistakes. We can go wrong. We can introduce prejudices. We can introduce false information into all of my reasoning, and all of that can affect my intuitions as well. So it's just rationality is all it is, and therefore it's fallible. But it is rationality, and that's the key thing. It's not mystical. It's not magical. It's just the way the human mind works. And as such, it's as reliable as the human mind is. And we should trust it as much as we should trust our mind in any respect. I think that's right.
So we're going back to this question, Jack, of how do I know that Jesus Christ is the Messiah? How do I know that he is the Son of God? And then I ask you, well, how do we tell our children that? And I think the answer we're coming up with here is, ultimately, it's very difficult to explain it to our children or to make some argument that's absolutely, you know, airtight. And I think that's the place I want to go. Well, gosh, I should have an airtight argument here. This is such an important thing to me. But the reality is that I don't. There's something that has mysteriously, not magically, but mysteriously invaded my heart and my mind and convinced me through my intuition and convinced me through my experience and convinced me through reading the Word of God. Put all those things together and there's this coherent whole and I'm living my life by it.
And the key thing is to understand that that mysterious process is eminently rational, ultimately. It's not that I don't have a warrant. It's not that I don't have a reason. It's not that I don't have good reasons for believing what I believe. I don't believe it in spite of reason. I believe it because of reason. And the fact that I cannot articulate the reasons doesn't negate the fact that the reasons are there.
Now, why are you putting such an emphasis on this, on reason? Are you afraid people won't hear us if we don't talk about reason or rationality?
Well, two things. Partly is cultural, but partly because I think God gave us reasons to be that which warrants beliefs. I mean, I really do think reason is the justifier of my beliefs. I think that's what makes our beliefs justified, is their being rational.
But they're not rational in the sense that I can argue them.
No, exactly.
And I think that's where people can get lost. In fact, I was getting lost with you. I thought, gosh, I have to argue everything. I have to know it through some kind of logical process. And
no,
that's not what you're saying.
No, my point is exactly the opposite of that, is that what the skeptic is going to do is say, well, Christine, give me a proof. Give me an evidence. Give me an argument. Tell me why you believe it. And then you kind of stumble around and say, boy, I don't know if I can articulate it. And then they point the finger at you and you say, you have no right to believe it. If you can't give me your reasons, you have no right to believe it. Well, you know, I would argue, look at all the things we don't have any right to believe, therefore, if that's true. Can you prove to me that your husband loves you and that this is not some kind of fake, that he's really has you deceived? Well, you'd really stumble around being nonplussed. I mean, can I rule out all the logical possibilities? No. But on the other hand, do I have bona fide knowledge that my husband loves me? Absolutely.
Well, you know, I grew up thinking, I just am too dumb to get things like electricity. I remember learning electricity or trying to learn it and saying, well, how come when you put the wires together, this works? And they'd give me these answers that were like mush talk. And it was like, it's coming out of nowhere. It's how do we know it? And then I'm trying to learn ham radio. And there's these radio waves or something, electromagnetic something. I don't even get it, Jack. All I know now is I just got to learn this stuff to pass the test because I want to understand. It seems like scientists are saying you've got to understand all these things. They put it in really strong words that sound really important and seem like they really know what in the world's going on. And you know what I think? I think they don't know what in the world's going on. They've just got a lot of fancy names to understand, to try and describe what they see evidence of. But there's a lot of intuition. They've got to believe that there's electricity in the air or whatever because it's working.
Yeah, I mean, is there any ultimate mystery behind what they believe? Yeah, I think so. When you get down...
When you keep going down,
down, you ultimately get to some mystery where...
And
you
I
know,
loved
just
it.
Know that it's
I, was,
the case.
I was talking to this guy who does physics, at least, Chris Swanson, who works at Gutenberg College. And I was kind of trying to follow this logic with him, and I don't think I'm describing it really well now, but we were on some some concept. And I said, well, how do you know that? Okay, he could tell me. Well, how do you know that? Well, he could tell me. Well, how do you know that? And he said finally, oh, well, we don't know those things. We just have to kind of believe those things. There's no real answer. And it was such a relief to me. I just, thank you, Chris. I loved it because it was like, oh, okay, that's what my intuition says. We can't know a lot of stuff, and we do live a lot of our lives out of our intuition. And we've just, I think we have this sense of control when we're able to say, I know what this is, and I can name it.
My particular position, though, would be to not make a distinction between knowing something and assuming something. I think there are some things that we just know, period. And we can't give a defense, we can't give an argument. For example, my own existence. How do I know that I'm not a figment of your imagination or your existence? How do I know that you're not a figment of my imagination? Ultimately,
well, you know, because I bug you enough, and you, you should know by now.
But ultimately, I would argue that I know that I exist more surely than I know anything that I would possibly point to as evidence of my existence. That it is such a basic, fundamental part of rationality itself. It's like just a built-in assumption to human rationality is I exist. And there are certain starting points that cannot be argued for. I can't give an argument for them. I can't defend them. I just know them. And for people to argue that that's somehow not knowledge then, I think misses the whole point. Not only is it knowledge, it's the foundation of all knowledge. Some things we just know.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have an argument for, they just
right.
are.
And we don't, and the main point in all this is that we shouldn't be embarrassed to claim to know things when we can't articulate an argument for them. That we really shouldn't. Knowledge is much more complex than we make it out to be. We don't just know the things that we've proved to ourselves. We know all kinds of things that we couldn't possibly in a million years prove to ourselves. But we know them nonetheless, and we know that we know them. And we need to allow ourselves to know that we know them and not be intimidated by skeptics who are coming along saying, I will not permit you to claim knowledge for that if you can't prove it.
And I think with this other safeguard, we need to be willing to check it out and always be willing to check out what we know against reality.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of people, Jack, who have lost track of reality in their minds.
Right.
And when you say it's simple, we just know that we exist. Well, for some people, that just isn't simple for them. And they have to come back and say, do I exist? They don't know that they do. The very basics they've lost. And so even while we're talking, my heart is kind of going out to people who live in that tortured existence and can't really know anything, and they're trying so hard to explain it. But ultimately, all these people can know is to feel and be comforted by the love of another human being that really seeks to know and understand and see with them. And that's where their intuition can click in. And that's the only place their intuition can click in.
Okay.
So we have to be careful, because there's a lot of people walking around like that that don't know and feel so lost because they don't.
Most of the time, our relationship to our culture is like a fish to water. It is as though we are swimming in our culture. It surrounds us everywhere we go, and it can have a profound impact on the way we think and the values we hold. Because of its collective nature, culture can create momentum for ideas and beliefs, evil as well as good. In his News and Views article, Culture, Friend or Foe, McKenzie Study Center teacher Wes Hurd takes on the question of how should a Christian live in a post-Christian world. Wes argues that all too often the church is more aware of modern, non-Christian points of view and how they are biased against the biblical worldview than it is about its own cultural assumptions, which are much closer and often more damaging to its life. As believers, we need to know the truth of the gospel, and this includes understanding how the culture we live in can distort the gospel message and feed it back to us in ways that might seem to make sense. However, in this post-Christian world, we may have even more opportunities to share the gospel with others in fresh and meaningful ways. Call McKenzie and ask for your copy of Wes Hurd's Culture, Friend or Foe.
It's always interesting for me to hear a little bit of history of how shows began, and the way this show began was, Jack, they really wanted you to come on because you are a real student of the scriptures, and they wanted to be able to share your learning over the last 25 years with a larger group of people than you can influence just in the town of Eugene. And so that was really the primary purpose. But you started talking, and you know what happened is you got kind of boring. So they asked me to come on to help make it more personal, more interesting, and just kind of liven it up some, and to bring in more of a counseling perspective also. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so we received this letter really recently, and it really speaks to what we're trying to get at. And I thought I'd read it to the audience and just share some perspectives. And this is pretty much what we received from a lot of people in terms of their input. Your discussions are a constant source of encouragement, motivation, and comfort for me. I know when I turn your radio program on, whatever your topic for the day, I will hear your earnest efforts to present God and scriptures in clear, practical ways. Most importantly to me, I know that you will open a few windows on your personal lives that show even in your maturity you are not perfect. This seems rather trite to say because I know that many listeners write you the same. Indeed, it may be the greatest achievement of your broadcast. And that really thrills me. I'm so glad for that people are hearing some reality. So many times, Jack, I work with people who have to hide from the people in their church what's really going on in their lives because they're afraid they're going to be seen as not mature and in some way ostracized. And she goes on to say, but in my close to 3 decades in the church, I can count the number of times I've heard leadership being honest to the point where they really showed themselves in a negative light without somehow redeeming themselves at the same time. It's not the failures and errors are never revealed by leaders, but in my experience, they are typically revealed in such a way as to make the leaders look strong, good, and different from others. I was taught that leadership should only reveal sin in the most carefully controlled ways, but the effect of your willingness to show what is in your hidden thoughts and actions has a very strong effect on me. And I am just so thankful that this has a positive influence on this person. I have to say for me, and won't speak for you, but it really is very difficult to share the negative without having, you know, a positive spin on it. This person and many people have expressed appreciation for our broadcast. We appreciate the letters. We also are continuing to encourage people to support us financially. The broadcast has not huge financial needs, but certainly we have ongoing financial needs, and the contributions aren't as strong as they need to be. And so we strongly encourage people to go ahead and consider, will you support Christianity at Work if it has had vital impact in your life?
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.